Hello, and welcome back to A Good Book Review, a podcast where we sit down and we review a wide variety of books which have been written for a Christian audience. My name is Chase Vitor, and this is Alex Daniels.
Hey, everyone. Today, we are so incredibly grateful to welcome Dr. Karen Swallowtie onto the podcast for the first time. On today's installment, Dr. Tyra will be unpacking her own book on reading well. The illustrated edition of this book was published in 2018 and is available on Amazon at the time of this recording for just under $14.
Yep, that is correct, Alex. At the time of this recording, Dr. Pryor is a research professor of English and Christianity and culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. She's also authored numerous books, which we would highly encourage our listeners to check out. On today's episode, we're incredibly excited to have the privilege of listening to Dr. Pryor unpack one of her own best-selling books. Dr. Pryor, thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of your busy schedule to be on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First question we have for you here. What initially compelled you to write On Reading Well?
Well, you know, I am an English professor, as you mentioned, and have been for about 30 years now. And when I first started teaching, especially when I moved to a conservative Christian university where I taught for 20 years, I found that a lot of students and their parents were kind of nervous about reading. They didn't read very widely. They often were skeptical of reading works by non-Christians. And so I wrote a book before On Reading Well called Booked: Literature and the Soul of Me, that was kind of encouraging Christians to read widely and read beyond their comfort level. But here we are in, 2021. And when I wrote the book and a couple of years ago, the digital age has exploded. People are all over social media, reading blogs, writing blogs. They're on Twitter. We're reading all kinds of things. I think we're reading a lot more, and that's good. But what I've noticed is that we're not reading very well. So it was kind of like a shift from quantity of reading to quality of reading. There's no shortage of things to read out there, but I think we really need to develop our skills to read well and learn how to apply what we read to the development of our character and our faith.
Okay. Who did you have in mind when writing this book in terms of audience?
Well, of course, whenever you publish a book, the publisher is someone who has a built-in audience. And so Brazos, my publisher, is a Christian publisher. So I was writing for Christians, but they also publish works that are designed for people who, are college educated or in college, who probably read a little theology and philosophy and are thoughtful, engaged with the world. And so my audience really comes built in with the publisher and who they're targeting. And that's the kind of readers that they're aiming for.
Awesome. That makes sense. What would you say is kind of your driving thesis? I know you kind of identified that in the first question there, but if you could hammer that home for us.
Yeah, I mean, there are actually sort of two aspects of my thesis. I believe that that we can actually cultivate virtue through the practice of reading well. And that's not only through kind of the lessons that we might learn from literature, which is part of it. And that's an important part. I talk about that. But also just because literary reading requires certain virtuous skills from us, like patience and diligence and attentiveness and employing perspective and discernment. And so if we read good literature, we're actually developing those kinds of skills. And then of course we're weighing the kinds of lessons that we are offered in these wonderful stories.
Awesome. Going off of that, could you speak further to the value, perhaps the necessity for the Christian to be well-read? How would you format like an argument to a Christian who might say, I can easily set aside time to read theological material because I see its value in direct proportion to my relationship with God. Why should I consider spending time reading other literary genres?
You know, I get that question a lot. As I said before, everyone's reading now, and that's great. There's so many books out there and blogs and articles and so forth. And a lot of people think that reading fiction or reading poetry is a waste of time, and nothing could be further from the truth, because we are creatures made in the image of the God who is the Word. And our ability to think in language and to communicate through language is a reflection of of being made in his image. And so when we are reading works that use language artfully and well and evocatively, then we're actually developing our ability to use this gift of language that God gave us. And fiction allows us, in particular, which is, you know, what I write about primarily, fiction allows us to see other worlds and other experiences through language. So we're doing two things at once. We're developing our linguistic skills, and we're also developing our perspective and all of the virtues that I talked about before.
Well, awesome.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Speaking kind of critically here, we looked on Amazon at some reviews of the book, and one critic on there wrote this, the start of the quote, "As a college professor of literature myself, I was hoping to share this book with my students so that they too could see the benefit of reading well that Prior explains so eloquently. But I cannot use this book in my course. My students are so diverse in race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and religion that the narrow scope of Prior's book selections would ring hollow with them. Somehow, despite what I am sure is Prior's broad knowledge of literature, she chose only one book by a non-white person, and even that book tells the story of two white priests who go to Japan to convert people living there to Christianity." Dr. Prior, and that's the end of the quote there, as a professor yourself who specializes both in English and in culture, where do you land on that critique, and what do you believe is worth considering there?
Sure, I definitely take that kind of criticism to heart. I think there's sort of an underlying assumption there that I would correct, and that has to do with my broad knowledge. In academia, we actually all have specialties, and my specialty happens to be 18th century British literature and the early English novel, which covers 18th and 19th century. So most of the writers that I have studied and I have expertise in are dead white men and a few women. Who are also dead and white. And so that's that's my expertise. I have other colleagues actually who teach American literature, African-American literature, Eastern literature. And so even though I read those works and I am also expanding my literary horizons all the time in what I read, there are just things that I have less expertise in. I actually did try to mix up some of the books in On Reading Well with other works that I'm familiar with. And they just happen, they happen to be works that, that are not Asian or African, or other things. But I had a person, a friend of mine who's also a writer, give a similar criticism to the book before she read it. And I said, well, just read it and then tell me what you think. And when she read it, she realized that this is why I love all good literature, is because it taps into universal themes about the human condition and human existence. And I actually talked in the book, as I do in my classroom, no matter what I'm teaching, about current issues of race and social justice, because these works are great because they can be applied to so many things. So I think that person is I understand his or her criticism, but the people who've read my book have actually found that my ability to talk about the things that are going on right now that affect so many of us here in America and across the world actually is a model for how we can read all good literature.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
And that book that they're referencing, is that Silence?
Yes.
Awesome. Really cool. Going back a little bit, you mentioned the three different parts, like the virtues, the cardinal virtues, the theological virtues, and the heavenly virtues. Neither of us are familiar with these categorizations, and could you walk us through how you derive them and maybe distinguish the categories for us?
Yeah, of course. These are categories and traditions that we find in philosophy and moral philosophy specifically, and that actually is not something that I'm trained in. So when I knew I wanted to write about literature and virtues in literature, I had to do a lot of research in moral philosophy and virtue ethics. And so these are not categories that I created. Actually, there are there's so many different virtues and different lists and categories, ones that come from Greek philosophy, ones that come from ancient Rome, ones that come from Christian tradition. And so I just really kind of picked a few of the categories that are most common. And those are the cardinal virtues that are pretty universal and not disputed. And then the Christian or heavenly virtues, there are seven of them, but the two of them are the cardinal virtues, and the theological virtues, which are found in Christian tradition. So these aren't categories that I made up, but they are the ones that I selected because they seemed like some of the more basic ones that we might all enjoy learning about.
Yeah, Dr. Pryor, you mentioned that there were, of the seven heavenly virtues, two of them cross paths with the cardinal virtues. Which two are those in the book?
Those are, I believe, now I, yeah, the cardinal virtues are prudence, courage, justice, and temperance. So I think that the two that are heavenly are temperance and courage, but I'd have to double check.
Okay. Very cool. Awesome. Awesome. Well, over the 12 virtues that you have listed there, are there any in particular that stand out to you as especially admirable? Obviously, I'm guessing you could probably make the case for all 12 of them, but are there any that are particularly desirable within your own relationships that you especially appreciate?
Yeah, your point about them all is true and interesting. And one point that is made over and over in virtue ethics is that to be a virtuous person, you actually have to have all of them. And you can't have courage apart from prudence and all those. But it's a good question about which one. I think that living in kind of in the age that we are in, which is so individualistic and self-centered and self-focused in a lot of ways. I think kindness is the one that we all, our own personal relationships can always benefit from kindness, but also just like the strangers we interact with or used to interact with before COVID, I guess, but the strangers we interact with on the street or whatever. We all are blessed so easily, I think, by small acts of kindness. And if you, in my chapter, I talk about how kindness, true kindness, isn't just about like being nice. It's not like being pleasing. It's actually more than that. It's actually the root word from which we get the word kindness is the same word that we have that it means kin or family. And so it's real kindness is really treating others as though they are like family. I mean, we could think of the parable of the prodigal son, right? Treating a stranger as though he's someone that we care for the way we would someone in our family. So I think kindness is a virtue we could all use more.
Mm, yeah, retweet on that one. Dr. Pryor, this one's kind of off the cuff here for you, so I don't expect a super thorough answer, but just curious, aside from reading well, what other activities could you think of that would cultivate virtues especially well, if you've given any thought to that?
Actually, this is a really good question because I talk all the time about reading and the virtues of reading and how important reading is and how much I love reading. But I also recognize that not everyone loves to read. And there are, I know, woo, imagine that. and there's, so this is just, you know, me talking about what I'm passionate about. But there are people who make things with their hands or who grow gardens or care for animals or care for children or who like numbers. I don't understand that, but you know, these are all ways that we can develop virtue and glorify God and love one another. And so I'm talking about my thing, but I actually hope that people will take away from my thing kind of how we can love the things that we love well and love them in a way that glorifies God and serves our neighbor.
That's excellent. To kind of summarize it, what is the best reason to read this book for our listeners?
well, it is a book. It is a book for people who are interested in learning how to read literature, like literary works, the kinds of books that you read in college. And it's also a book for people who are interested in theology and philosophy on a sort of basic level, because I'm not a professional philosopher or a theologian. So I think it's a good introduction to all of those things for anyone who's interested in learning more about them. It's not a book for everyone. I mean, my mom you know, I give all of my books to my mom, and she's in her 80s, and she said this one was really hard to read, and you know, it's written for, you know, it's written for people who are kind of already interested in theology and philosophy and literature, but it's, I think it's a good introduction for those who aren't professionals in those fields.
I didn't
even answer your question, did I? Why should you read this book? I don't know. It has beautiful illustrations by Ned Bustard, who is an artist, and these are original pieces of art. And I actually wanted to include those because I do realize that some of the writing is a little dry and theoretical, and I just thought the pictures would help bring those stories alive.
I actually think when I first showed my fiance my copy of that book, I think that's the first thing she noticed was how beautiful the artwork was on the chapter heading.
Good.
Another side question here for you, Dr. Pryor. I'm guessing some of our listeners for the podcast will probably be especially interested in reading from you just based on how likable of a personality you've got even. What are maybe some more introductory books or ones that would be a little bit less less dense in material that require less attention that could be more enjoyably read, for lack of a better word?
I am so glad you asked that. I don't even remember it, you know, us discussing this, so I don't know if you're throwing it in there, but it's a good question. So I have actually just, I'm in the middle of producing or editing a series of classic books the titles we all know, Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, those kinds of books. It'll be a 6-volume series. 4 of the volumes are out, and they include the texts of the novels, and I write introductions for each of them that are for people who've never read the works before, although people who love them tell me that they're really enjoying them and learning more. And I put discussion, I have no spoilers in the introduction, so you can read the introduction without having the plot ruined, read the text, and I have discussion questions throughout. And so really, it literally is that one of those books is like taking a class with me, because everything I talk about in the introduction is what I talk about in a class. And then the discussion questions are the kind that I would ask in a classroom discussion. And so those are books that I think someone who's just kind of at an introductory level might enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's also pretty heavily evidenced. Just on your Instagram account, I see you sharing a lot of stories that come from other people who are really enjoying your recent book. So, yeah, that's awesome. Last question that we have related to the book here. What is maybe the most important topic or idea that we haven't already discussed that our listeners should know about the book?
I don't know. I think, well, maybe what we haven't discussed is how the first chapter, the introductory chapter of On Reading Well, is kind of I've had people say that that chapter alone is worth the price of the book, because it's really just an introduction to how to read well, without even getting into any of the stories, but just an introduction to the virtues, the introduction to what it means to read well, and what digital media is doing to our brains, and how to read better. So that's something we haven't touched on. Just read the first chapter.
Could you maybe, just as a bit of a sample for our listeners, could you maybe attest a little bit? I really enjoyed the introduction with kind of what you talked about with just how our brains are being shaped by a new digital media, social media age. Could you talk a little bit about that, just to give our listeners a taste?
Yeah. And of course, I'm citing experts who've done this kind of research. One of them is Nicholas Carr, who wrote The Shallows. Another one is Marianne Wolfe, who's written a couple of books on this topic. One of them is Reader Come Home. And these and other cognitive scientists are finding that when we read digital media, whether it's Twitter or even reading books on computers, because of the light and the digital makeup, we're actually using a different part of our brain. So we're exercising the front part of our brain, which retains less and has a shorter term memory. But when we read a printed book on a page, we actually are using the deeper recesses of our brain where we retain information more. And so if you think of any other kind of muscles in the body, we want to exercise all of the muscles, but if we exercise, you know, one group of muscles more than the others, then the others become underdeveloped. And that's an analogy that we can use for our brain. So if you feel like I'm old enough where I know what my brain worked like before the digital age, and, you know, I have more difficulty focusing and paying attention to a book and I'm an English professor than I did 10 years ago. And I think it's, you know, again, because of the way that we're using our brains differently. And so that's something to pay attention to, I think.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Very relatable. Now transitioning a little bit more broadly here, Dr. Pryor, away from on Reading Well and more so towards your experience thus far at Southeastern Baptist and also towards your years at Liberty. Obviously, you've been an English professor for, you know, 3 decades, as you said. We have here with us Elise Eisted, who, if our listeners are familiar with episode 10, she was one of our featured guests on there when she spoke on Oswald Chambers, My Utmost for His Highest. Elise, we're bringing in here to ask a couple of questions just because she's an English major at a public university here in Eau Claire. And so she might have some unique insights as she's asking these questions for you, Dr. Pryor.
Yeah, it's so exciting to meet you. I actually introduced Chase to your work, and so I take full credit for this episode.
Well, full credit given.
Thank you. So yeah, one question I have is, as an English professor, what has your experience been in relating the arts to Christianity? And like going along with that, how can art, which is not explicitly developed for the Christian, still be of value to the Christian?
Well, you know, I actually, I am a product of entirely secular education and did my PhD at a state university. So it was more culture shock to me to transition, even as a Christian, from, you know, a public school environment to teaching at a Christian school. So there were some, you know, some things that I had to adjust to. And so one of those gets to the heart of your question is just, I mean, I grew up reading a lot of books. You know, I grew up in a strong Christian home. I grew up reading widely. I was an English major in undergrad, went into a PhD program at a very liberal university. And so just had, you know, always felt that I benefited and learned from reading secular literature, and in some ways learned more about how to be a Christian and how to think like a Christian from those books and from Christian ones. I didn't read a lot of Christian books because, again, these works of literature are considered great because of the way they address universal, unchanging themes of what it means to be a human being, and they reflect the pattern of creation, fall, redemption that is the mark of all great stories. So, you know, so I think Christians just need to have a little encouragement and a little bit of exposure to the way these great works of literature actually do reflect Christian truth, and to learn where they don't, to discern that. I think it's a wonderful way to test all things, as Scripture admonishes us to.
And then also going off of that, so perceivably English and other majors in the liberal arts have become an increasingly secular field of study. And as you said, you did do your education in secular universities, but what has been your experience teaching English literature in a Christian college classroom?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that the reason these fields in the humanities have been overtaken by secularists is because Christians have largely abandoned them. And so then it becomes kind of like a vicious cycle. They get more liberal and get more secular. And that's really a shame, because if we look back in history, we see that Christians throughout history were among the greatest writers and artists and musicians. And we've kind of lost that place in our culture. So so when I teach in a Christian environment, I'm really hoping to help students regain that sense of our own heritage, that we've been part of giving to the world some of the greatest works of art and the greatest accomplishments the world has seen. And we need to recover that. And it's really only in, you know, in very recent time in Christian history where we haven't been the leaders in those fields. So let's go back to it.
And what topics, themes, and content do you put value on for the curriculum of the Christian English student then?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we, you know, again, my specialty is very traditional. It's, you know, it's not very up to date or edgy. And so I teach within that field. But I think, you know, I see my colleagues teaching really a lot of the same things that anyone would teach in any university environment. But we actually We teach more in that sense. I've actually taught in a secular school at the same time I was teaching in a Christian university, and I was be teaching the same works. But in the secular classroom, I felt like I was really just kind of skimming the surface because I'm talking just about the literature. Now, that's a lot. I love literature. But in the Christian classroom, I'm not only talking about the literature, but I'm making the connections that that literature has for us to life and to faith and to God and the purpose of our existence. And so that's so much fuller and richer. And so for me, that was an interesting experience to be teaching, at the same time in two different schools. And I think Christian students, when disciplines are taught well in a Christian environment, then we're really, really going deep. We're teaching that discipline, that material, but we're also connecting it to the whole of the Christian life.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Pryor, for answering those for me.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Dr. Pryor, we do want to be respectful of your time and also of our listeners, and so we're kind of at the threshold there for the time we've set aside, but we do want to just express very clearly our deep thanks to you and gratitude for hopping on the podcast with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a great conversation. I appreciate having it.
If our listeners are interested in hearing more from you, what resources could we commend to them? Where could they go to hear more?
Well, I have all of my books and a few articles on my website, which is KarenSwallowPryor.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at KS Pryor or Instagram, Karen Swallow Pryor. And I often post visual things there. So, or you can just Google me and find the things I've written. Or I have an Amazon page too, I guess.
I can highly suggest. I've thoroughly enjoyed getting to follow you on Instagram since I started. That's been wonderful.
I'm so glad.
Listeners, as we always say, if you're interested in reaching out and getting in touch with Alex or myself, please feel free to email us at agoodbookreviewpodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again next time with episode 19, where our very own myself will be debriefing Elliot Clark's Evangelism as Exiles. Until then, take care and God bless.
See you guys later.